Next case on our calendar, 06-1061 and 06-1069. Mr. Farmers Cooperative Exchange Company versus Roger Meyer. Justice Cupp has recused himself from this case. We're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Cupp, Judge Peggy Bryant, who is the Judge of the Court of Appeals in the 10th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Bryant.
Thank you.
Mr. Niemeyer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, Justice Bryant, counsel. My name is Brian Niemeyer. I'm here on behalf of the appellants in these consolidated cases, two individual farmers, Roger Meyer and Robert Deuce, who had open book accounts with the appellee, Minster Farmers Cooperative Exchange, in this matter. And we're here to ask the court for some direction to the courts of appeals as to the proper manner in which interest should be calculated on open book accounts pursuant to 1343.03 of the Ohio Revised Code. The central question before this court is whether invoices and account statements that contain interest charges in excess of the statutory rate provided for in 1343.03 and are not signed by the individual debtor or not provided to the debtor until after each individual transaction has been consummated is sufficient to constitute a written contract under 1343.03 of the Revised Code. A secondary issue, which Mr. Burton will address on his cross appeal, is the manner in which interest can be compounded in these types of situations. I will first address the issue with respect to 1343.03, and that statute provides that when money becomes due and payable on any book account, the creditor is entitled to interest at the rate per annum determined pursuant to 5703.40 of the Revised Code, unless a written contract provides a different rate of interest. The central question then becomes, what constitutes a written contract? Five appellate districts in the state of Ohio, notwithstanding the third district, that have addressed this issue in similar types of situations involving interest that is stated on an invoice or on a monthly statement subsequent to the transaction at hand. Five appellate districts, the 2nd, the 4th, the 5th, the 10th, and the 12th, have held that those statements contained on invoices and monthly statements after the fact do not, in fact, constitute a written contract as required in 1343.03 and as contemplated by the legislature.
Counsel, in this instance, you had some delivery tickets that were also involved, as well as invoices. Is there anything in the record to suggest that your client signed the delivery tickets when the goods were delivered?
No, there is not. This matter was decided on summary judgment. There's really no evidence in the record as far as how many of these transactions, delivery tickets were involved. The majority of them, as I understand it, involved the invoices, the monthly statements. There were some instances apparently where a product may have been ordered by either Mr. Meyer or Mr. Deuce from Mr. Farmers. Presumably their account was charged at that point in time. The product was then delivered to their residence along with a delivery ticket that also contained that interest.
But no signature on the delivery ticket?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
Counsel, what's the effect of Champaign Landmark versus McCullough on the determination of the contract, existence of a contract here?
The Champaign Landmark case is a third district case. Obviously, that's where this case arose out of. That case is in the minority in terms of other appellate districts that have addressed this issue. In that case, the facts were similar to this particular case. There was a farmer who purchased feed and or fertilizer, et cetera, some sort of elevator, I would assume. One distinguishing factor in that case, Justice O'Connor, would be the fact that the defendant in that case, the farmer, wrote a letter to the creditor acknowledging the fact that I owe you 24% interest, but there was a drought this year. I don't have the money now. Will you accept 14%? And I think the court the language used by the third district in that decision was that they found that to be a most enlightening fact in that case.
Well, wasn't in this particular case there was a complaint that the interest amounted to over 30% by your clients, complained of that to the minister's cooperative, correct?
That's correct.
But that was some time after the interest had, that they had made payments on that account with that interest rate.
That's correct.
So what weight or effect do we give the fact that your clients had continuously done business, not only at the 24% interest rate, or actually it was more than 24 because they were compounding it.
Right.
But prior to that, I believe it was 18%, 1.5% per month?
That's correct.
Were they compounding at that time?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, so your clients all along were conducting business, looking at their invoices, seeing what the interest rate was, continue to order on a month-to-month basis and do business, acquiescing to this entire situation, and then after, I guess, an inability to pay or to pay the full amount, complained about the interest rate, and then the court, the appellate court, dropped the interest rate down to 2%, so it's 24% per annum as opposed to the compounding. I'm kind of at a loss as to how that differs from the third district's opinion in Champaign, and whether it was a written acknowledgement. Is it the timing? Is that what you're saying makes a difference when the farmer here objects?
Well, and while I'm thinking about it, I didn't reserve any time for rebuttal. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Watch your time.
I think a couple things, Justice O'Connor. You mentioned my clients acquiesced. Acquiesce doesn't satisfy the written contract requirement in 1343.03. Presumably were not aware of 1343.03 and the fact that there had to be a written contract when they receive these invoices after they've purchased material saying, oh, by the way, we're going to charge you interest at 1.5% or 2% compounded. They didn't say compounded, but they say 24% annually, and then they did compound. I think another distinguishing factor is the fact that the letter Mr. Meyer wrote was addressing a different situation, and he mentioned in that letter as a kind of a side comment that, hey, by the way, you guys are charging me interest, and it's in excess of 30%. He wasn't, as in the Champaign Landmark case, he wasn't acknowledging that I owe you interest. I agree. The farmer in that case acknowledged that he owed 24% interest, asked them to accept a lesser amount.
This wasn't, you're charging me 30%, or it should be only 24?
No.
So he didn't say that in so many words, but he was saying that
he was questioning the amount of the interest being charged. Yes.
Okay. Did he say that? Gee, it should be only be the statutory rate of 10% or whatever it is.
No.
No. He just. It was more a question of the compounding versus the annual.
That's correct. I believe that to be true. Yes. Yes. The five appellate districts that have addressed similar situations, and by the way. Justice O'Connor, further commenting on your question, in those cases, there were circumstances where payments were made on invoices for a matter of 2-3 years in some of those cases as well. And you know, we have this same, quote, acquiescence of the interest charged. And then it came to a head, obviously, when the payment stopped and they couldn't make the payments anymore and the attorneys got involved. And then they addressed the 1343.03 issue. But those appellate districts that have addressed this issue in favor of the argument that we're asking the court to address today have held essentially that there are two prerequisites to charge an interest rate on a book account higher than the statutory rate provided for in 1343.03. Number one, you have to have a written contract between the parties. That's fairly straightforward. That's specifically set forth in the statute. Number two, they said the contract must provide the rate of interest. The contract must specifically state the rate of interest to be charged. those courts have interpreted a written contract to mean a writing to which both parties have assented. I submit to this court that there are no writings to which either Mr. Farmer or Mr. Deuce has assented with respect to the interest. The invoices, the monthly statements, even the delivery tickets, which were unsigned, these were all after the fact, after each individual transaction or purchase from the co-op occurred. There was never any assent to the interest rate when the transactions occurred and when their respective book accounts were charged. In addition, I would submit that the second prong of that test that has been enunciated by the courts of appeals that have addressed this issue regarding the contract specifically providing the rate of interest to be charged also cannot be met in this case, because although their invoices, their monthly statements provided 2% per interest, they all had a parenthetical that said 24% per annum or 24% annually, whichever the case may be. Whereas in effect, they were charging significantly more than 24%. They were compounding that interest on a monthly basis, which resulted in an effective interest rate of in excess of 30%. So I would submit to this court that neither of the prongs that the five appellate districts that have analyzed this case in our favor have set forth can be met by Mr. Farmers in this case.
Are there provisions in the revised code that allow for amendments to contracts to provide for things like interest charges on accounts?
Yes, and I assume you're referring to the UCC, the 1302.10.
Well, I'm just going to ask about it. Yeah. I have that in mind, yes.
Okay. Yes, there are.
What's your best argument that that shouldn't apply?
Well, two things. Number one is the fact that these transactions were all consummated. When these gentlemen went into Minster Farmers and purchased their feed or their fertilizer, they walked out with it. Later, they got an invoice after the fact. They could not have assented to the interest being charged. The transaction itself had already consummated, so there is no battle of the forms under 1302.10. There's no battle of the forms here. There's that statute addresses a situation where an offer is made, then an acceptance is sent back with additional terms, and whether those terms are material or not, that simply did not occur in this case. And I would say secondarily to that is the fact that we have a specific statute addressing statutory interest in 1343.03, whereas we have a more general statute, 1302.10, that talks about what terms are going to be included in a contract among merchants if the acceptance includes some additional terms. Doesn't say anything about interest, and the legislature didn't draft any sort of exception in 1343.03 that says contracts that might be implied under the UCC or implied by law or by some other statute will satisfy the written contract requirement.
What weight should we give to the course of conduct between your clients and the exchange?
In what respect?
In respect of paying interest for a number of years.
Well, it goes back to the comment I made earlier, I think, Justice O'Donnell, the fact that, you know, these farmers received these invoices and they assumed that they owed the money because that's what the invoice said. And Mr. Farmers was adding this 2% every month to invoices that were sent out that for money that was past 30 days. I don't have a good explanation of the fact they didn't know any better. They didn't know that Mr. Farmers, that they had to assent to a specific interest rate before Mr. Farmers could charge interest over and above the statutory rate.
Do we have any cases that indicate you can have a written contract without either or both parties signing at the end?
Not that I'm aware of. None of the cases that I've addressed in my brief.
The terms of interest here are stated in writing.
Correct.
But neither party signed the document. So,
can that
be a written contract?
I could
or
see.
Or is there is there case law or is there anything in the U.S., in the UCC that says a contract in writing has to include the signature of both parties being bound by
no,
the contract?
No, I'm not asking this court to find or hold that 1343.03 requires a signature on behalf of the party to be charged. I could see a situation where there would be an offer that specifies an interest rate. There would be an acceptance sent back without a signature that accepts the interest rate to be charged. And then I think you have your written contract then under 1343.03, but that didn't occur in this situation.
But conduct itself can't accomplish that.
I do not believe so. Conduct itself, it's not a written contract, which is expressly required under 1343.03.
Thank you, Mr. Niemeyer. Okay. Your time has expired.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Burton.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'm Mike Burton. I'm here today representing Minster Farmers. I would like to reserve, I guess, 1 minute for rebuttal on the cross appeal issue. I think the question that this court has to ask itself is when there's a contract for goods between merchants and everyone agrees that the underlying contract is governed by the Uniform Commercial Code, how is the interest term then interpreted? I think that's the central question that the court has to ask itself. It's true that at least I'm unable to locate any Ohio case which expressly discusses reconciliation of the relationship between the UCC in Chapter 1302 and the statutory provision regarding interest in 1343.03. I see it as the court has three alternatives today. Two of those alternatives mean the appellee, Minster Farmers, would win, and in my opinion, Ohio would join the majority of states that have dealt with this issue. The other alternative is offered by the appellant. In my opinion, it's a very narrow reading of the written contract requirement of 1343.03, and I think it would add Ohio to the minority of states. I would ask the court to look at the arguments in the brief that we made in Proposition of Law Number 1 and Proposition of Law Number 4. Combine those arguments. I believe those arguments best reconcile the existence of 1302 and 1343.03. I think the court would look to the statute of frauds provision, which is in 1302.04, as well as the battle of the forms provision, which is in 1302.10. Combine those and say that they satisfy the written contract requirement of 1343.03A. The UCC governs this transaction.
Are you suggesting that the facts here are a written contract, or that we can dispense with a written contract because the UCC allows it?
I think that the court could do either, Your Honor, but my initial contention is that this case, since it's under the UCC and it's for goods, that it also satisfies the written contract requirement. There is no definition. If you look to 1343.03A, there is no definition that defines what that means in the statute. And counsel for appellant has even admitted in his argument that, in his opinion, to satisfy the, quote, written contract requirement, you don't have to have a piece of paper that's signed at the bottom by both sides.
When you have a document, though, that comes post-transaction and is signed by no one, those are the facts we have, are you contending that is a written contract?
Well, let me address one other issue first, Your Honor. I think that the appellant's counsel mischaracterizes the situation a little bit. A number of the products that were here were would have been propane gas deliveries where the customer had said, deliver my gas on a regular basis. Minster Farmers goes out, delivers gas, and leaves a delivery ticket at the house, which has got these interest terms. Other alternatives are the farmer comes in to the physical location at Minster Farmers, walks next door, picks up some binder twine, some rope, some supplies, and leaves with a little invoice that acknowledges the transaction. And that little invoice also has the interest provisions. Now, it's also true that then on a monthly basis, these gentlemen were sent statements. But I think it's kind of a mischaracterization of the facts to indicate that these tickets were just sent subsequent to the transaction being completed. Secondly, it would be our contention that when read together, the UCC provisions as well as the statutory interest provisions together, that yes, in this specific set of facts, the written contract requirement is satisfied because the UCC provisions exist. In my opinion, to hold as the appellant wants the court to hold, 1302.04, 1302.10 may as well not even exist.
Well, 1302.10 may create a contract for you, but it doesn't mean that it creates a written contract under 1343.
Well, again, I think everyone has acknowledged that the very definition of written contract is what we're here to talk about. And even appellant is saying that it doesn't have to be something signed at the bottom by both of the parties. The course of dealing, the invoices being sent, and I mean 1302.10, as well as official comment 5 to 1302.10, specifically say that the additional term of interest can be added after the fact by a confirming memorandum being sent. That's exactly what was done in this case. And to hold the way the appellant asks you to hold ignores that statute exists. We would urge the court, it's very interesting. If you look at the Ohio cases on this topic, there are a number of cases that are sale of goods cases, Champaign Landmark and those types of cases, that talk about 1302.04 and 1302.10. It's interesting, those cases totally ignore the existence of 1343. They never mention it. Likewise, the Hobart Brothers line of cases, which is relied upon very heavily by the appellant, that line of cases where he says five appellate districts interpreted in this fashion, not one of those cases cites the Uniform Commercial Code and says this is a transaction between merchants for a sale of goods. Not one of those cases say that. So therefore, what we would say to the court is the rule that should be crafted is that to reconcile these statutes, that when one has a sale of goods between merchants, you can reconcile these statutes to say that the written contract requirement of 1343.03 is satisfied by the course of dealing, the invoices, and also referring specifically to the language of 1302.10.
Well, we would, it seems to me, have to define the term a written contract in a way that might surprise some people, would it not? Course of dealing and so forth, that's not really how a written contract is. Certainly it's not, it certainly wouldn't be the way that the average person would interpret that term, is it? A written contract is something that you have terms and it's in writing and both parties have signed it.
Your Honor, I would urge the court that in the context of the UCC, the underlying policies of the UCC to facilitate commerce, that it does satisfy the definition of written contract. The UCC did away with the old common law mirror image rule. You know, offer, acceptance, exact agreement. That's exactly what 1302.10 exists for. It says you don't have to have the mirror image agreement any longer to have a contract. The appellant agrees that there's a contract. The appellant agrees that the contract is governed by the Uniform Commercial Code. The appellants haven't complained about quantity. They haven't complained about price. They don't raise the statute of frauds as a defense to the underlying contract. They don't do any of those things, Your Honor. They simply come along and say, well, we've got this issue on interest.
Which the statute expressly addresses. UCC expressly addresses that issue, does it not? I mean, that whatever they say about, you know, their dealings, that we have a statute that's 1343.03 that says unless a written contract provides a different rate of interest in relation, you know, to the money and so forth becomes due and payable. How do we get around that by saying, well, there was a course of dealing here. It doesn't have to really be a written contract. Even a written piece of paper, I guess.
The course of dealing is important, Your Honor. But I'm reaching a little further and simply saying that 1302.10 says when a confirming memorandum is sent and there is no reasonable objection, a contract exists. Official comment 5 to 1302.10 then goes one step further and says that as to the interest term, it can become an additional term added to the contract in that manner.
Added to the written contract. Don't you have to go back to the statute that expressly addresses this issue?
Well, I'm
10, as you know, is a general statute, and we have a specific statute.
Not in my opinion, Your Honor. It doesn't work that way. I mean, and I've offered some cases in our brief. I think there's some other states. Wisconsin law.
Before you get to that, Mr. Burton, let me follow up.
I'd like to have him finish my question or my point, if you would. Go ahead. You mentioned Wisconsin law, and you were going to say something else, I think.
Well, I was going to refer to there are other states, and when looking at their statutory interest statute, which is similar to 1343.03 here, those states have ruled in the fashion that Minister Farmers urges. They have such statutory interest statutes, they say things such as, in Wisconsin, in a case such rate shall be clearly expressed in writing. In Idaho, when talking about the statutory interest statute, when there is no express contract in writing, Idaho, the Supreme Court of Idaho, when using a statutory interest statute in Code Section 28-22-1041, when using a statutory interest statute that said, when there is no express contract in writing, fixing a different rate of interest, et cetera, Supreme Court of Idaho used exactly this argument to say 1302.04 and 1302.10 operate to satisfy the statutory interest requirement of that particular state. Likewise, Iowa, their statutory interest statute says, unless the parties shall agree in writing. The state of Iowa in review video, as we've cited in our brief, have said you can look to the UCC provisions and the UCC provisions will govern the statutory provisions in that context. So we've offered a number of other states that we think, you know, with similar language have looked at it that way.
Justice O'Donnell has a question for you, I think.
Sorry, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief. You referenced comment 5 to the UCC codified in 1302.10, but as I read that, it says, where a clause providing for interest on overdue charges or fixing the seller's standard credit terms where they are within the range of trade practice and do not limit any credit bargain for. We don't really have that here, do we?
I believe you do, Your Honor, because when you read...
Where is the clause that would provide for interest on the overdue charges?
I think there's the clause which is sent in all of the confirming documents.
You think the memo at the bottom that says 2.5% interest on unpaid balance is the clause. Is that what you're arguing?
That's correct. Also, where the debtor fails to object from the standpoint of how does one bargain for
it? Do we know that is within the range of trade practice?
I think...
do we just infer that?
Well, at this stage, from the standpoint of the record in this case, that's not an argument that's been made by the appellant, and it's not an argument that was made at the summary judgment phase, and it's not an argument that's been made at the Court of Appeals. So as the record exists in this case, I don't know that the court has to consider that. I mean, now you're asking evidentiary questions, and that argument really hasn't been made by the appellant.
Counsel, what is the usury rate in Ohio now for this type of transaction, sales on open account?
I don't know if I can specifically answer the question, Your Honor. I mean, I think the customary rate would be 1.5%. Is probably a little bit more customary. 1.5% per month would be a little bit more customary.
Yeah, but usury is
criminal usury, Your Honor, is anything in excess of 25%. Now, that I got 28 seconds left on my time, and that goes to my second argument in the cross appeal, which is, I think I would just refer the justices back to our brief. I think I argue it basically in my brief that you have to look at all of the confirming documents that were sent, and they all say 2% per month on amounts not paid by the end of the month, 24% annually. I think the appellant wants to focus solely on the 24% annually.
But how do you get to 24% annual? Because what you are doing is compounding.
And what we did, Your Honor, each month we sent an invoice to the appellants.
Which includes the interest from the former month, which you are adding 2% to as well.
We also sent them a separate invoice for the finance charge solely.
Right, but you are still charging 2% on the amount that is overdue from the last 2% that wasn't paid. And if you had said instead 2% and didn't say anything about 24% or 2% compounded, I wouldn't have a problem with your argument. But to say 2% and 24 clearly states that it's not a compounding interest. But you clearly are compounding, are you not?
We are. We are. And what I would urge the court is, that as to that issue, if the court determines that some ambiguity exists because of the language, that we still are permitted to charge the 2% per month, as I've outlined for the other reasons throughout my argument.
Thank you, Mr. Burton.
Thank you.
Mr. Niemeyer, you've used your time, which may take 30 seconds.
Mr. Burton commented regarding the five appellate cases and the fact that they did not address 1302.10. I submit to this court that they did not address that because they didn't have to. It was not applicable. They didn't have to go there because they looked at and analyzed correctly 1343.03 and found that there was no written contract. Therefore, there can be no interest above the statutory rate. Also, Mr. Burton talked about comment 5. It does reference that additional terms included in clauses, as Justice O'Donnell pointed out. However, it doesn't. First of all, that's a UCC comment. The UCC doesn't know anything about 1343.03 when they adopted that comment. Secondly, it doesn't say anything about interest over the statutory rate. It talks about interest, and I agree that as long as interest is below the statutory rate, that interest can be included as an additional term in the form of an acceptance and be included in a contract under the UCC, but that's different than the situation that we have here today. Mr. Burton referenced other states' laws. I would refer the court to my reply brief in which I addressed his arguments. Other states have similar type laws, but not identical, and not specifically requiring a written contract. And those decisions are certainly distinguishable from the argument that Mr. Burton is making.
Thank you, Mr. Niemeyer.
Thank you.
Mr. Burton, you've used your time, which may take 30 seconds.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I would have nothing further to add. I'm satisfied that we've submitted our case.
Okay. Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.